Well, I'd like to start off today by asking a few questions. What good would it do to have Christ sacrifice if we didn't leave the camp of Satan's world? What good would it do, or what benefit, rather, is there in taking the Passover if we don't keep moving forward? What is our objective now that these 7 days of unleavened bread are almost over? And they are over now. And how diligent are we with the things God has given to us? Well, if these questions sound a little familiar, it's because we heard those questions during the last two sermons on the last day of unleavened bread. So I'd like to restate those questions in a slightly different fashion this morning, and let's see if we can find a common thread or a common denominator. How do we leave the camp of Satan's world? By making good decisions. How do we keep moving forward? By making good decisions. What should be our objective now that the days of unleavened bread are over? We should strive to make good decisions. And how can we be diligent with the things that God has given to us? We can be diligent by making good decisions. You know, the decisions that we make in life are critical to our spiritual growth and development. So now I'd like to pose a couple of my own questions here today. What kind of decision maker are you? Do your decisions come quickly, or do you have to chew on things for a while before coming to a decision? To me, decisions can be classified and grouped in different categories. First type of decision I like to view as the automatic decision. Some may label this the involuntary decision. You know, if you're grilling out and you touch that grill, you make an immediate decision to move your hand. If your child or your grandchild is learning to walk and they begin to stumble, you make an immediate decision to lunge out and try to keep them from falling and hurting themselves. When you're traveling down the road and you spot a policeman with his radar on, your foot immediately slams on the brakes. At least mine does. And no matter how fast you're going, my foot immediately goes off the gas to the brake after checking the speedometer to see how fast I'm going. If your wife asks you for money, your hand immediately goes to your wallet to protect it. And I guess one could argue that these are reactions instead of decisions, and I really couldn't disagree with that classification for the most part. You know, first there's the automatic or the involuntary decision. This type of decision is almost reactive in nature. Next type of decision I like to call the immediate decision. Now, when I get dressed and go to the wardrobe to pick out a tie, I think about the color suit I'm wearing or maybe the shirt, and I pick out a tie. You know, I don't sit there at the wardrobe and think and analyze, well, if I wear the black and white tie, and this is black and white, it's kind of hard to see here this morning. If I wear the black and white one today, I can wear perhaps the blue one next Sabbath, unless it rains, and I might wear the yellow one because the blue one's my favorite. I don't want to get it wet. I don't go through that type of analysis in order to pick out a tie. Now, perhaps some of you may put a little more thought into the tie that you're wearing. If I'm going to a wedding or something and there's color coordination, you know, and if it's purple or lavender or pink or something, I may try to find a tie that's a little more conducive to that. But for the most part, it's an immediate decision to me. You know, if we're interested in going out to lunch and if we're interested in Mexican, let's go to Tumbleweed. Well, I went there yesterday, so let's go somewhere else. How about Chewy's? Let's do it. We make that decision and off we go. So we immediately decide, and I consider these to be immediate decisions. And then there's the more complicated or more complex decisions. Do I sell my home or do I keep it for another 5 years? Do I stay in my current job or do I try to change companies? Should I go back to school, or would that be too hard on my family? Do I have back surgery now, or do I just wait to see how it plays out? Usually these type of decisions require a lot more analysis and more time to make up one's mind and come up to a decision. Of course, the ramifications and the consequences are much more severe than me picking out a wrong tie to wear to church in the morning. And as a result of the severity or the complexity of certain decisions, sometimes these complicated decisions even become deferred. We don't like making a decision right off the bat because it is complicated. There's a good number of reasons for this. Perhaps you've looked at all the various outcomes on a decision and you don't like them. They're not very pleasant to think about. And sometimes fear comes into the picture. You may not want to go to the doctor or find out exactly what is wrong. Sometimes we don't act out on something because we're afraid of the consequences. Sometimes we make the decision to not do anything because we may be taken wrong. May not go to a brother or a sister, perhaps, as Matthew 18 tells us sometimes, because you may be viewed as being harsh or insensitive or misunderstanding. So we make a decision to defer the decision. Well, good decision making is a process. It really needs to be learned over time. We don't have the ability automatically to make good decisions when we deal with these complex decisions and situations that come up in life. Back in 2014, Harvard Business Review published this article. It's called 9 Habits That Lead to Terrible Decisions. 9 Habits That Lead to Terrible Decisions. And I'd like to take a few minutes and read this. I feel it's a lot of good information that can be extrapolated from this article. But just a little background on how they stumbled across this. They came up with this idea to have a new leadership development program, and they thought, after doing some research, that when people embarked on a self-development program, their success increased dramatically if they were encouraged along the way. So they developed this software that people would enter their goals, and then the software on a weekly or a monthly basis would come and kind of remind them to keep on going. They invested a lot of time and money in this project, but as it turned out, people did not like receiving the emails and found them more annoying than they did to be beneficial. Some of the users even came up with a name for this type of software. They referred to it as Nagware. Nagware, because they felt like they were being nagged. Sometimes my Fitbit, when I'm wearing it, okay, Dave, 10 more steps, you know. Sometimes it's encouragement. Sometimes I feel the same way. It's kind of nagging a little bit and kind of annoying. Left foot, right foot, Dave, you know, all the messages that comes up on the Fitbit. So in analyzing their failure in this endeavor, they asked themselves, what causes well-meaning people to make poor decisions? And they came across these 9 habits that lead to making terrible decisions. Here's 9 factors to the most common goals that, or the common paths rather, 9 factors or the 9 common paths to making poor decisions. And here they are in order from most significant to least significant. The first habit that leads to making terrible decisions is laziness. Laziness. This showed up as a failure to check facts, to take the initiative, to confirm assumptions, to gather additional input. Basically, such people were perceived to be sloppy in their work and unwilling to put themselves out. They relied on past experience and expected results simply to be an extrapolation of the past. A second factor that led to poor decision making was not anticipating unexpected events. They didn't anticipate what could possibly happen during this endeavor or project that they were working on. You know, it is discouraging, they write, to consistently consider the possibility of negative events in our lives, and so most people assume the worst will not happen. Unfortunately, bad things happen fairly often. People die, they get divorced, they have accidents, markets crash, house prices go down, friends become unreliable. There's excellent research demonstrating that if people would just take time to consider what might go wrong, they're actually very good at decision making. Sometimes people get so excited about a decision they're making, they never take out the time to do that simple due diligence. So not anticipating unexpected events is a second reason. Third reason is indecisiveness. Indecisiveness. At the other end of the scale, when faced with complex decisions that will be based on constantly changing data, it's easy to continue to study the data, to ask for one more report, or perform yet one more analysis before a decision gets made. When the reports and analysis takes much longer than expected, poor decision makers delay. Any opportunity is missed. I work for a company back in the early 80s who introduced a type of video disc player. It was a capacitance electronic disc. They called it CED. And this endeavor to build this disc actually started back in 1965. But they waited 15 years to launch this. And by the time they got around to launching it, the capacitance disc, if you got a dust speck on that disc, had to be kept very clean. If you got a dust speck on it, the capacitance would change and you get some artifacts in your picture or lose the sound. And by the time they launched this, Philips had come up with the laser technology that actually read the data below the disc, and it was a much superior project and device that ended up being built. So if they had introduced this back in around the late 60s instead of waiting to 1980, they would have been ahead. But this other one came on board, and so they lost out on an opportunity. It says often indecision is worse than making the wrong decision. They invest a lot in this factory. I became a part of that. And after about 2.5-3 years, this factory went out of business up in Bloomington. Those most paralyzed by fear are the ones who believe that one mistake will ruin their careers, and so they avoid any risk at all. Well, fourth reason that people make poor decisions is remaining locked in the past. Some people make poor decisions, they write, because they're using the same old data or processes as they've always have. I know some businesses that started back in the 50s developed a certain model, and as the times changed, they didn't, and they are no longer in business. Such people get used to approaches that worked in the past and tend not to look for approaches that will work better. But too often when a decision is destined to go wrong, it's because the old process is based on assumptions that are no longer true. So poor decision makers fail to keep those base assumptions in mind when applying the tried and the true. Fifth reason why people make poor decisions, or terrible decisions, as it's worded here, they have no strategic alignment. They have no vision on how this particular decision or decisions along the way work into the overall strategy. Bad decisions sometimes stem from a failure to connect the problem to the overall strategy. In the absence of a clear strategy that provides context, many solutions appear to make sense, but when tightly linked to clear strategy, the better solutions quickly begin to rise to the top. Or when tightly linked to a clear strategy, those better solutions will rise to the top. But sometimes people don't have any kind of strategic alignment. Sixth cause of poor decision making is overdependence. Some decisions are never made because one person is waiting for another person who is in turn waiting for someone to finish this or provide some kind of decision or input to them. Effective decision makers find a way to act independently when necessary. So sometimes we just can't wait on others. We have to step out and do what we feel is right to do in order to succeed. Reason number seven is isolation. Some of those leaders are waiting for input because they've not taken steps to get it in a timely manner, or they've not established the relationships that would enable them to draw on other people's expertise when they need to. So they don't have this networking that has been developed to actually call out the expertise. An eighth factor that leads to poor decision making is lack of technical depth. A lot of decision makers don't have technical depth. Organizations today, they write, are very complex, and even the best leaders do not have enough technical depth to fully understand multifaceted issues. And sometimes they don't understand the implications of the decisions they make. Good decision makers make sure that they find the talent in order to help them. And then the last reason or factor that lends itself toward poor decision making, according to this article, is failure to communicate. Failure to communicate the what, where, when, and how associated with their decisions. Some good decisions become bad decisions because people don't understand or even know about them. Communicating a decision, its rationale and implications is critical to the successful implementation of a decision. So there's a number of reasons that, according to this Harvard Business Review article, why people do not make the best decisions. So before we start looking at what God reveals in the Bible, I'd like to lighten it up just a little bit. Over the years, there's been a number of people who have made bad decisions. And as they made those bad decisions, here's a few of their famous last words. Of course it's safe. I can pass this guy. Pull the pin and count to what? Which wire was I supposed to cut? I've seen this done on TV. Again, famous last words. I know it's early, but I hear you chuckling inside, though. I'll hold it while you light the fuse. Let it down slowly. So you're a cannibal? I wonder where the mother bear is. Are you sure the power is off? Now watch this. Trust me, I know what I'm doing. What's in this dark cave? What's the light at the end of the tunnel? Nice doggy. No, he doesn't bite. Look, Ma, no hands. Don't be so superstitious. These are the good kind of mushrooms. Bet you can't do this. So I'm sure a lot of people have made bad decisions. And again, those are a few of the famous last words, if you will. You know, God has made available certain principles to us that we can make right decisions. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. Because what we decide to do in life, that is the decisions that we make, directly affect the quality of life that we're going to have. Let's look at an example in the Bible in which someone approached the God of Israel to help solve a particular problem. 1 Samuel chapter 1. They were having this particular problem and they brought it to God, and let's see how God responds. 1 Samuel chapter 1, just kind of read a few of the highlight verses here. Now, there was a certain man in verse 1, 1 Samuel 1 and verse 1. There was a certain man of Ramathaim's Sophon of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroboam, and he had two wives. One of them was name was Hannah in verse 2, and the other name was Peninnah. Now, Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Dropping down to verse 4, and whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he'd give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all their sons and daughters. So she had sons and daughters, at least a family of four. It was plural. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb. So Hannah was unable to have children at this point. And so her rival, Peninnah, also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed up her womb. And it was year by year when she went up to the house of the Lord that she provoked her, and therefore she wept and did not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to Hannah, "Why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" Well, evidently, Hannah didn't think so, because the next thing she did was go to the tabernacle and pray for a son. So Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking. Shiloh, now Eli the priest, was sitting in the seat of the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord, and she was in bitterness of soul. She prayed to the Lord, and she wept in anguish, talking about Hannah here. She made a vow and said, "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look upon the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservants, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head." So evidently, he was become a Nazarite. And it happened that as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli watched her mouth, but Hannah spoke in her heart, and only her lips moved, and so her voice was not heard, and Eli thought that she'd been hitting the bottle too much, and she was drunk, and he said to her, "How long will you drink, or be drunk? Put your wine away from you." And then in verse 15 of 1 Samuel 1, Hannah answered, "No, my Lord, I'm a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman. Far out of the abundance of my complaint and grief, I have spoken unto now." You know, during his time in Israel's history, there wasn't a considerable amount of prayer that was being gone on. So Eli offers some encouragement and actually a great promise here. And Eli answered and said, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel will grant your petition that you have asked of him." And so Hannah bears a son in verse 14, or actually I think down in verse 20. "So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked of him from the Lord." You check the margin, you learn that the name Samuel means heard by God. So God heard Hannah's prayer, and thus the name of the baby became meaningful. Then in chapter 2, Hannah offers up a prayer to God. Notice Hannah prayed and said in verse 1 of chapter 2, "My heart rejoices in the eternal. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. No one is holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you, nor is there any rock like our Lord." And if you continue on here, well, let's just read verse 3 here. "Talk no more so very proudly. Let no arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is the God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed." So God gives knowledge, and by God actions are weighed. The Hebrew word for weight here is takan. Takan. It means to balance, to measure out by weight or dimension through the idea of leveling or equalizing or testing. Through the knowledge of God, our actions become measured out. They can be weighed or leveled out. In other words, we can obtain balance by going to God and seeking out his help in those decisions. So Hannah's prayer continues through verse 10 here. And her prayer, if you read it, reminds me of a lot of David's, King David's prayers in the Psalms that he said. But Hannah appeared to have a good spiritual insight at this juncture. And down in verse 11, "He will give strength to the king and exalt the horn of the anointed," in verse 10, and down in verse 11 now. "Now Elkanah went to his house at Ramah, but the child ministered to the Lord before Eli the priest." So Hannah kept her promise to God. She gave up the child that she finally had obtained in an effort to serve God. So she committed young Samuel to the priesthood, and the prophet became established in Israel as a prophet. You can just jot down 1 Samuel 3, verses 19 and 20 to confirm that. But God blessed Hannah for her actions in the keeping of her bargain. She told God that she would dedicate this child to him. She would place him in God's service, and she followed through on that. However, you can't outgive God. Notice the additional blessings, 1 Samuel chapter 2, dropping down to verse 20. 1 Samuel 2 and verse 20, "And Eli would have blessed Elkanah and his wife, saying, the Lord will give you descendants for this woman for the loan." Again, talking about Samuel, that was given to the Lord. And they would go down to their own house, and the Lord visited Hannah so that she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. Meanwhile, the child Samuel grew before the Lord. So she apparently was blessed with five more children and may have ended up with more children than Peninnah did, Elkanah's other wife. But Hannah took her problem to God, and God gave her the help that she needed. She made a wise decision. So today I'd like to give you seven steps or principles on how to make godly decisions. Point number one, this actually was mentioned in the sermonette. Point number one, ask God for wisdom. At least wisdom was equated with salt. Ask God for wisdom. You know, knowledge is different than wisdom. If someone has knowledge, I can learn and I can gain that knowledge from that individual. If someone is an authority on something, then you can go to them and you can gain knowledge from them. On a recent trip to Israel, we acquired much knowledge about the nation of Israel. It's only about the size of New Jersey. We learned about the three or four sources that actually feed the Jordan River, and the Jordan River runs down and feeds the Dead Sea eventually. We learned and visited where the tribe of Dan was located. We learned about and visited the fortress of Masada. We learned about the four quadrants of the Temple Mount, all the nationalities and the peoples that now make up that, on the Temple Mount. We saw the ruins and learned about the history of Megiddo. We learned that the Israelis like to eat very well and ate some of the greatest meals in that country that I've ever had in my life. But if someone has knowledge, then you can gain that knowledge and acquire that knowledge from them. You know, the same is not true with wisdom. If someone has wisdom, then I can't learn wisdom from them. And so while knowledge can be transferred from one individual to another, you can't do that with wisdom. True wisdom, the ability to be able to successfully apply knowledge, in a godly manner, to have the understanding to be able to apply knowledge in a godly manner, comes from God. True wisdom comes from God. Let's notice Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3. Clock up here says 10:13, so I guess I got an hour and 45 minutes before we have to be out of here. Cool. Proverbs chapter 3. In verse 5, I won't keep you that long. It says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. You know, the book of Jeremiah makes it very, very clear that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Jeremiah 17 and verse 9. But we can't lean on our own understanding. We can't look upon our own carnal heart. In verse 7, in all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. And so we are to look to God for his wisdom instead of relying upon our own abilities. Dropping down to verse 11 here. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor detest his correction. For whom the Lord loves, he corrects, just as the father the son in whom he delights. Now, being a father was not always an easy task. You know, correcting your children is usually not much fun or something that we necessarily take delight in. Many times we wish our children just would have gotten it the first time that it was brought up. I'm sure that God says the same things about you and me at times. But it takes time to grow, takes time to develop. You know, someone once likened trials to medicine. Medicine tends to correct certain anomalies or certain situations. Likewise, trials can fix imperfections in our life and only God knows what type of medicine that we need from time to time. Verse 13, happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding, for her proceeds are better than the profits of silver and her gain than fine gold. She is much more precious, talking about wisdom, than rubies. And all the things that you may desire cannot compare with her. I've mentioned before that some of the crown jewels are over on display there in the Tower of London. There's the King Edward's crown, the Queen Elizabeth's crown is there, and it's just filled with these beautiful rubies, along with the gold and silver there. There's these scepters that have just these marvelous, beautiful rubies. A lot of them are illuminated by bright lights that make them even more spectacular. But as beautiful as those are, God says they're not to be compared to what wisdom can do for us in our lives. In verse 16, I believe the days is in her right hand, and in her left hand, riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. She's a tree of life to those who lay hold of her, and happy are all those who retain her. So notice that we're not only to lay hold on wisdom, but we are happy or blessed, as the word means, if we retain wisdom. We retain something by holding it close to us, protecting it, never letting it slip away from us, never letting it go. We need to look to God for his wisdom. So when we encounter a major decision, ask for God's wisdom. Look to God in every major decision. Over in James 1, let's just pick up one verse there. James chapter 1. Verse 5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally, without reproach, and it will be given to him. So we need to ask God for the wisdom to make the right decisions in life. As they say, a word of the wise is unnecessary. Word of the wise is unnecessary. There's great advantages to coming to possess wisdom. For one thing, wisdom guides us into making godly decisions. And the only disadvantage that I can think of having wisdom is that you come to realize how foolish you've been at times in your life. When you come into wisdom, you realize all the times before that wisdom came, perhaps how foolish you've been. But that's a cheap price to pay. Be humble anyway. So point number one, ask God for wisdom. Point number two, search God's word for examples. Search God's word for examples. You know, the book of Proverbs is a good place to start. We've already read several of those, and we'll read some more before the end of the sermon. But over in Hosea chapter 4, let's do look at that passage. Again, it's a familiar passage, but Hosea 4. Daniel, Hosea, in verse 6, Hosea 4 and verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will reject you from being priests for me. Because you have forgotten the law of your Lord, I will also forget your children. You know, there's two major problems here. First of all, they rejected God's knowledge. And secondly, they forgot the law of their God. They forgot to keep God's laws. You know, the law of God is revealed through his word. Knowledge of the right way is revealed through his word. You know, blessings are afforded to those who make the right decisions in life. Many examples are recorded in the Bible. And you see blessings as you examine those examples that come upon those who make the right decisions. And you see curses or problems or ramifications that occur when poor decisions are made. King David did some mighty good works, made a lot of good decisions, but he also made some wrong decisions in his life. And his family suffered for many, many years. But my people are destroying for lack of knowledge. We don't have to fall into that category. We have access to God's instruction manual that he has given to mankind. Proverbs chapter 16. Let's look at another proverb here. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 20. Proverbs 16 and verse 20. He who heeds the word wisely will find good. You know, you can't heed the word unless you read the word. He who heeds the word wisely will find good, and whoever trusts in the Lord, happy is he. And so as we look to God's examples, as they pertain to decisions that we make, insight will come. God will give us wisdom if we're looking to him. You know, if you're thinking about acquiring something in the budget that may stress out your finances a little bit, examine all the passages, look at the word contentment. If we're facing a health trial in our life, review God's word on his faith and his healing. So look at the examples in the Bible where God came through on his promises. So point number two, search God's word for examples. Point number three, get all the facts. Get all the facts. And not only get all the facts, make sure that they are accurate and complete facts and correct. Oliver Goldsmith, an author and writer in the 18th century, once said this. He said, "When I've made up my mind, I always listen to reason because it then can do me no harm." So once I've made up my mind, then I'll listen to everybody because it can't harm me. I'm sure he said that in jest, but sometimes we don't tend to think through it completely before doing something. After the fact, we may go, if it doesn't turn out the right way, we may say, well, you know, maybe I should have looked at this aspect or that aspect. I think it's wise, and I think we understand it's wise to get the facts. Proverbs chapter 18, let's go back a couple here in verse 13. Proverbs 18 and verse 13. He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is a folly and a shame to him. So make sure that we get all the facts before making a decision. We shouldn't be pressured into making decisions at times. There's the one end of the pendulum where you wait too long to make a decision and you miss out on an opportunity. The other end of the pendulum is where you make a snap judgment and make a snap decision and it comes back to bite you. I recently bought a television for downstairs and the salesman tried to make me take out the extended warranty. And if you take out extended warranties, I guess it's sort of a insurance policy, but everything that I've read on extended warranties, you'd just be better off not accepting any of them and just fixing it when something does break. But he tried to pressure me into this extended warranty, and I just told him, well, we have 30 days to decide. Yeah. So, I'll get back to you on this then. One way to kind of make them be quiet about certain things. So if you don't buy a warranty next time, don't blame Dave if it breaks on day one after that warranty expires, though. It is a gamble with electronic devices or any mechanical devices. They do break eventually. But it's good to sit down and list the pros and cons on a piece of paper concerning a major decision. And in some cases, as I mentioned, it is good to wait and to think things through. You can wait too long, that's the other end of the spectrum, but there's a right balance. Again, that's why we go to God, point one, in the first place. So get the facts, make sure that the facts are accurate and updated. Point number four is seek wise and abundant counsel. Seek wise and abundant counsel. As I mentioned, we need to seek out God first and foremost. That's why we put step one as step one, approach God and ask him for wisdom, but also seek out the advice of others. Try to find someone who has perhaps gone through what you're going through. If you're thinking about buying a house, talk to somebody who's bought a house. You can gain a lot of good information there. But at the same time, if somebody still is renting instead of buying a house, it's good to talk to them too to find out the advantages of renting. For one thing is that usually the maintenance and upkeep of the ground, so it's automatic, somebody else takes care of that. When you have to maintain 77 acres, that sounds very appealing to me at times, just to have somebody else do all the work. But you can gain things. Sometimes it's just an economic decision. Maybe they can't afford a house and they're waiting to buy a house, and renting is done by them at that point just because they're still trying to acquire it. But it's good to talk to both sides on any decision to look at the pros and the cons. It's good to explore other factors. Seek ministerial counsel. Our ministry encounter a number of different people and diverse situations that crop up from time to time, dealing with work or school or marriage or a number of different other areas. And our ministers are quite good counselors. They have a lot of experience with that. We need to seek out their advice and counseling when it comes to making major decisions. We used to do that perhaps a little more than we do now. You know, if I called Mr. Adams this morning and asked him what kind of tie that I should wear, I'm sure he'd give me some input just because he's a nice guy. But I didn't want to bother Mr. Adams about what color tie that I was going to wear. I can choose some things on my own. I can choose my own tie. I can pick out my own color of the car. But on the more important decisions, it's good to seek out ministerial and other types of counseling. There's plenty of opinions that you can find on the internet. That's why we have to ask God for wisdom, because there's a lot of good advice on the internet. Likewise, there's a lot of bad advice on the internet. But we should seek wise and abundant counsel and ask God for wisdom to separate the wheat from the chaff. Proverbs 11 and verse 14. Proverbs are full of tidbits of knowledge and wisdom. Proverbs 11 verse 14. Where there is no counsel, the people fall, but the multitude of counselors, there is safety. So we need to look to others for advice. There is safety in numbers. And then once we've gone to God for wisdom, once we've searched God's word for examples, once we've gotten the facts and we've ensured that those facts are correct, once we have sought wise and abundant counsel, then make a decision. Point number 5, make a definite decision. You know, when you put off making a decision, then you're making a decision to put it off. You know, once you've prayed about it and thoroughly, accurately researched it, then make a definite decision. We were in James 1 earlier, and we looked at verse 5. Let's pick up where we left off there. James chapter 1. James chapter 1, beginning in verse 6. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting. James 1 and verse 6, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. He's a double-minded man, which means he has two opinions. He has two ways of looking at it and can't come up with one. He is unstable in all his ways. So make a decision. Don't keep waffling back and forth or deferring it. After careful and prayerful consideration of all the pros and the cons of both sides, of going both paths, then make a definite decision. Now, back in Deuteronomy, I'll just reference that. God comes to the point of telling the Israelites to choose. There comes to a point where you have to choose. Deuteronomy 30 and verse 19 and 20, I'll just quote that for you. But God says, I call heaven and earth as a witness today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that you and your descendants may live, that you may love the Lord your God, that you may obey his voice, that you may cling to him, for he is your life and the length of your days, and that you may dwell in a land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you. But we can't waffle forever. God wants us to go in a certain direction. He wants us to choose life, but you can't overlook the word that we have, or the fact that we have to choose to begin with. God says choose. At some point we have to choose. We have to make a decision. And God is watching those decisions that we make. So when we do choose, then we are making the decision on which path or way that we want to pursue. And then once you've made your decision, point number six, have faith in that decision. Have faith in that decision. Over in Psalm 37, get the facts, look to God, be prayerful and careful in our considerations, make the decision, and then trust that that decision is correct. Psalm chapter 37, in verse 7, says, rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. But we are to wait in the Lord. After we make a decision, we are to exercise faith. Wait and let God fulfill that in due time. And if we've sought God's help and we're trying to serve and obey him to the best of our ability, then he will uphold us. Notice verse 23, even if we do fall down at times, dropping down to verse 23, the steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delights in his way. Though he fall down, he shall not be utterly cast down. Sometimes we do fall, but if we're looking to God, God's going to pick us up, and we won't be cast down forever. For the Lord upholds him with his hand. God takes his hand, and he sees us through certain situations. So after you've made a decision and followed the previous steps, exercise faith. But look to God for your decisions and look to him for the faith to trust him to help work things out. Over in Mark chapter 11, let's go over to the New Testament. Perhaps you read this during the Passover examination as you went through one of the gospel accounts, Mark chapter 11. Verse 23 of Mark 11, Mark 11 and verse 23, for assuredly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that these things, he says, will be done, he will have whatever he says. Therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you will receive them, and you will have them. We have to believe in what we have chosen, and we have to have faith in that decision. I've probably mentioned this before over the years, but when I got out of high school, I immediately started working. I made a decision not to go to college. My dad didn't go to college. My mom didn't go to college. My older brother didn't go to college. And so I said, why should I? You know, at one time, we used to have more factories than we do, and it used to be possible to go out and get a job and in one of these factories and kind of stay there until you retired. Just be able to get on with companies like that. But a lot of those jobs have dried up over the years. Not all. There's a few that's left, and I know people who are successful without having gone to college. But I found myself married with one child, and I was in a low-paying job that I didn't like very well. So I made a decision to go back and pursue a degree in the electronic field. I was working 9 hours a day, 7:30 to 5, 5 days a week, and I went back to school 4 nights a week, 5 hours a night, and that didn't include at least a 45-minute drive back and forth to Louisville. So my weekends consisted of going to church, and then Saturday night and Sunday, I just had to study like crazy. I had to give up time with the family in order to go forward and to achieve that. After 6 months of doing that, I just couldn't take it. I needed a break, so I took 6 months off. Then I went back for another 6 months, endured it, got to the same point again. Oh, things are falling apart. We had just purchased a house and actually moved to a different house, and there were things to do. But I took another 6-month break. But then I went back and I saw the end in sight, and so I stayed with it until I got my degree. But it became a great burden for me because I was working full time and I didn't have time for the family, but I persevered. I obtained a degree and I got a job that I really liked. Actually, several jobs that I really liked. We're in Mark 11. Let's go to Matthew 11. Sometimes we make a decision and it becomes hard and you have to make adjustments, is what I'm trying to bring out here. But you can't lose sight of the goal. You have to get back at it at some point in order to obtain it. Matthew 11 and verse 28. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and we will give rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So I had to let go of my yoke and grab onto God's yoke from time to time. When I became stressful, I had to make adjustments and then go back, as I mentioned, a couple of different times in order to complete it. But I had to have faith in my confidence that it was the right decision for me, even though it was making my life very complicated at times. So sometimes you just need to cease, you need to rethink, you need to regroup, and then come up with an alternate game plan. But we need to stay the course if you're going to achieve anything worthwhile in life, even our pursuit of God's kingdom. Sometimes we fall down, and God will help us to rise back up if we look to Him. It becomes very challenging at times. But I finally got my degree. I got into a field I was very much excited in. And then that field led to another field of computers that eventually I ended up with, or ended up in. I think we read Romans 8, verse 28 the other day, but, you know, things work out for the good to those who love God if we look to God, if we trust Him in that. Over in James 1, we also read in verses 6 to 8, but let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, for he that wavers is like a wave of the sea, driven with the wind and tossed, for let not that man think he shall receive anything of the Lord. So we have to have faith, and we have to exercise that faith in the decision that we've made. And then, after seeking God's help, after looking to God in His Word for promises, after getting the facts, after seeking wise and abundant counsel, after making a decision, and after having faith in that decision, point number 7, work diligently for the desired effect. We have to work diligently. This was one of the points that Mr. Winter brought out on the last day of Unleavened Bread. We have to work hard to bring about that growth that we emphasize during the days of Unleavened Bread. We are to take on more and more the nature of Jesus Christ. He said that hard work leads to a productive life that leads to a happy life. No, the same is no less true of any major decision that we make in our lives. We have to work diligently for the desired effect. In the case I was pointing out earlier, my goal was to obtain my degree. I had to work hard, I had to make adjustments, and then I had to repeat the process over and over and persevere until that came about. I think this verse here was also either read or referred to, but Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10, I can just quote that to you. Not sure what time we have to be out of the building today, so I'll just quote that to you to save a little time. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where we are all going. So we need to work diligently to achieve the effect that we're seeking after. Someone mentioned to me recently, we're going down to Foundation Institute, and they were counting the number of inferences to the former pastor general or the former administration that we used to have. And they said, Mr. Pennington, I just can't relate to that. And I appreciate that to a large degree, but, you know, that was part of our heritage at the time. You know, when I came into the church, the pastor general had a big impact on me. And I remember him saying, and it doesn't really matter who says it. If it's right and if it's godly principles, then it's right and godly principles. But let me just say that the pastor general of the church, when I came in, used to tell us to look to God as if he were to do it all, but we have to roll up our shirt sleeves and act like we're going to do it all. So we look to God and we trust him that he's going to work this out for us, but at the same time we roll up our sleeves and we work like we're going to do it all ourselves. And when we do that, we show effort to God, then God will do his part. God, I firmly believe, helps those who help themselves. I just can't totally rely upon God. There's my part to play. And I think we understand that. In fact, Mr. Winter talked about that in the sermon this past week about the rewards. The rewards come from God, but it's based on what we do. So we were in Mark 11, now we're in Matthew 11, now let's go to Luke 11. I just noticed this on the drive over. I didn't plan for it to be that way, but a lot of 11s in there. Not sure what that means, except it comes after 10 and before 12. Luke chapter 11 and verse 9. So I say to you, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will knock and it will be open to you. For everyone who ask receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be open. I'm not sure I read that in verse 9. Sorry about that. But the bottom line is we have to ask, we have to seek, we have to knock. So make sure that we're doing our part in all this, in the decisions that we're seeking out God to help us with an answer. Make sure that we're doing our part. God will do his part. He is faithful. He has promised. He cannot lie. So God will do his part. We just have to make sure that we're diligent in doing our part in whatever we're trying to achieve or to obtain. As we conclude here over in Hebrews chapter 5, we'll look at verses 12 to 14. Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews 5 and verse 12. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles, the oracles of God, and you have come to need milk and not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are of full age, that is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. We must learn to be good decision makers. And as the Apostle Paul puts it here, we must have our senses exercised to discern good from evil. You know, this is our training ground. This is our testing ground. And once we make it into God's family, and yes, we must believe and have faith that we're going to do that, we will encounter important decisions down the road to make. The decisions that we make now will help instill the very nature of God within us and allow those good decisions down the road to occur. So build that holy and that righteous character. Let's remember and use these seven steps or principles. And with God's help, and with God's help, we can all learn to strive to make good decisions.